Oftentimes our art doesn't really reflect reality. I love you, I'll do this, I'll do that. Really, it's just words. Or we'll say something like, you're my best friend. He's one of my best friends. What do you mean, one of my best friends? Best as in singular. Well, it's my best, my bester, my bestest, my... We use all kinds of verbs that make us sound like we're tight, but oftentimes it's just verbiage. And today we're going to look at going beyond the words to actually taking a posture of sacrifice for our friends or in order to build a friendship. Let's pray before we do anything else. God, I pray that you would help us to emulate you more, to see your qualities and to have more of your qualities imbued in our flesh. I pray that our relationships would go to new places, not just our relationship with you, but our relationships with our friends, or that there would be friendships that would be stimulated in a fresh way as a result of the material we're looking at today. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about something that is not normal. I pray these things according to your character, your reputation, the person of Jesus. Amen. Proverbs 18:29 talks about friends, and it says this: a man of many companions may come to ruin, but there's a friend who sticks closer to than a brother. It's common to have a lot of companions, common to have a lot of acquaintances, common to have a lot of Facebook friends, but my goodness, when you find somebody who sticks closer than a brother, that is rare, that is unusual, that is valuable. Chuck last week talked about the different categories of acquaintances or people in our life. I'll call them the E's of friendship. There's some people who are an Eeyore. They're an Eeyore. You know, you're around them and you say, how are you doing? I'm all right. Did you hear what happened last week? They're like, oh, they're a human rain cloud. Wherever they go, it's scattered showers. It's just cloudy and gloomy. And it's one thing to be like that for a season of your life when things are difficult, but we're talking like years on and on. There's Eeyores. And then there are entertainers. They're happy, 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 happy. They always got the latest jokes, and they're fun to be around. And I actually like entertainers. I like having them around my life. They're fun to be around. But you don't really necessarily feel safe around an entertainer. You don't really feel like an entertainer is going to bend their life for you, to lay down their life for you. And you may not ever even see them grow or become a different and better version of themselves. But they're entertainers. Then there's encouragers, which he talked about. People who put courage in you, that's what an encourager is. They put courage in you to take you up to new places. They kind of pump you up and get you going new places. This is the kind of friend Jesus was. He took people around him to a higher level, either because he built into them or because he laid his life down so they could go up. Here's what he says of himself, and he calls us to in the book of John chapter 15. He says, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. I'll give you a little bit of literary history here. This, in the New Testament portion of the Bible, is written in Greek, but Jesus didn't speak in Greek. He spoke in Aramaic. When he would speak in Aramaic, then his followers who wanted to communicate his message to others, wrote in the language of the day, which was Greek. And there was two forms of Greek. There was classical Greek, which is the highest form of Greek, which the ancient philosophers and the ancients would use. And then there was the street lingo, the street slang, which was Koine Greek. The New Testament was written in Koine Greek. It was written in the street slang vernacular of normal friends to having normal conversations with people. Now, the word here in Greek, again, he didn't say this, but the way it was translated in Greek was the word agape, agape love. It's said to be the highest form of love. But in the ancients, the ancient Greek civilization, they rarely ever used this word. It was a word that would denote the love that somebody had who was higher on the org chart, higher in the hierarchical system of the day. The three main words that the Greeks would use to denote love was, number one, storge. Storge was the kind of love that you would have for somebody of your family, somebody who you shared DNA with, or somebody you are married to. Second kind of love is eros. Eros, which is where we get the word erotic. And it is just what it says. It's the romantic love. It's that chemistry that you have with somebody. When you meet them for the first time, you go, there's just something in the air. And then the third kind of love, which the Greeks believed was the highest form of love, was phileo. Phileo, which is brotherly kind of love, where you choose to be a brother to somebody, you choose to be a sister to somebody. This is why Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, comes out of this word, phileo, Philadelphia. Even though I refer to that city as Filthydelphia, it is also phileo, the city of brotherly love. And the ancients would believe that this third form of love was the highest form of love. The first form of love, you really don't have any choice over. You're related to somebody. Second form of love, it's almost like you don't have choice over that one. There's this chemistry you have with somebody that makes you an adolescent. You could be 30, 40, 50, 60, and you fall into love. It's like you have no choice of it. And all of a sudden, you start doing things you never thought you would have done, actually countering the character that you've been building because something strange has happened. And normally, it doesn't last at all, very long at all. This kind of love, it's a zing, dippity-doo-dah love, but it doesn't propel lifelong circumstances, lifelong character. But this third one is something you choose. You choose to be a brother. You choose to be a sister to somebody. You choose to lay down your life, what Jesus did for his friends. Maybe the best human illustration of this that I know of in the Bible is the relationship that Jonathan, who was the son of the first king of Israel, Saul, the relationship Jonathan had with David, who was the heir apparent king, who was anointed to be the next king, even though Saul didn't know this. David was a Renaissance man. He was a warrior, manly man kind of guy. And at the same time, he was a poet. He played the harp. He wrote poetry. And what happened was when Jonathan later on dies, David writes some poetry about him. And let's just go fast forward to the end and see what David says about this great brother of his. He says this, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." Now this verse, along with some others that are similar to it, would cause some people to say, Jonathan and David were in a homosexual love affair. It seems to say this, especially to us in the midst of our over-sexualized culture. We read sex into everything. Over-sexualized, over-sexualized. Or that's what she said. We read or hit like sexual innuendos all the time. It's one thing for humor's sake, but it's another thing to look at a verse like that and say, well, gosh, if they were that close, David must have been bisexual. He was later on married to a woman. Jonathan, we don't see anything about a woman. There must have been something going same-sex sex there. This communicates how we in our culture have such a bad ability to be intimate with people. It's like sex is the only form of intimacy we can think of. We try to read sex into everything, and we can't even see a pure, intense, intimate brotherhood friendship. I've heard guys coming back from World War II or Vietnam or Korea would say that the brothers that they fought with, there was a special bond that would surpass even the bond they had with their wife. It's hard to explain. This is the friendship that Jonathan and David had as warrior friends. Even today, Libby and I hear people say, well, my spouse is my best friend. Well, depending on how you define that, Libby's my best friend. I'd rather be with her than anybody else. She knows more about me than anybody else. She will support me and always has more so than anyone else. But yeah, at the same time, a friend is really not what we are. We're one. Before God, we are actually one flesh. And there are guys, friends of mine, who can speak things into me that Libby can't speak into me. There are guy friends I have who can identify with things I'm going through that she can try, but she just won't be able to. Same with her and some of her girlfriends. There's something powerful about a same-sex friendship that can take you to new places and gives you a sense of intimacy that you even can't have in the bedroom, certain kinds of intimacy. And we lost the ability to have these kind of deep friendships as a culture. We're just having associations everywhere, or we're having one-night stands, or Eros kind of relationships, or Thanksgiving kind of storge love, but this voluntarily laying my life down for somebody, sacrificing for somebody, rarely happens. What does it mean to sacrifice? It means to lay your life down three ways. Number one, we sacrifice when we waive our rights. Friends waive their rights. Things that you could have, things that you have a right to have, that you choose not to have. Jesus waived his rights when he died on the cross for me. He had an unjust trial. He was punished for an unjust crime, but he waived his rights because he was punished for crimes and rebellious acts that I have towards God. He died in my place. It was a form of him waiving his rights. But he waived his rights long even before the cross. The Bible says that Jesus was God incarnate even before he was born in Bethlehem. And so when Jesus comes to identify with us, his future friends, and takes on flesh, he waives his rights, some of the perks that came with divinity while he was in heaven. I don't know exactly what was up there, what he was going through, but I'll tell you what, he limited himself and waived his rights when he lived a normal human existence. Waives his rights. Jonathan waives his rights with David. Look how he does this in chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. So Saul is still giving David orders in terms of what to do, and Jonathan comes along and blesses him with gifts. Now, as the prince, as the second in command in the country, his sword would have been the second best or best sword in the whole land. It would have been the lightest, would have been the sharpest, would have had the most jewels on it. Same with his shield, same with his bow, would have been of the best wood. He takes his robe off, and not only would have been a fine, beautiful linen, but his robe and all of these battle accoutrements, what they symbolize to David is, I am waiving my rights as the heir apparent of the throne. I'm giving you my robe. I'm giving you all of the things that come with my royalty. I recognize you as the guy. I recognize you as the man. He's waiving his rights. This is what a sacrifice is, when you waive your rights. A sacrifice doesn't always mean that it's painful. Sometimes we think, well, I'm not sacrificing because it doesn't hurt. Sacrifice doesn't mean that it hurts all the time. And I know some people who have made very generous commitments in the Game Change, our Game Change campaign, and they say, well, that's not a sacrifice, as if, you know, I'm not hungry or starving, so it's not a sacrifice. Sacrifice doesn't mean that you're literally hurting. It just means you've chosen to waive something. Interesting, I take a look at Jesus' words about what he has done, the kind of life he's led, and he never refers to his actions as a sacrifice. Interesting. His friends after him look at the things that he's done and said and the modifications to his life, and they say that was a sacrifice. For Jesus, it was just laying his life down. It's just what you do when you're in love. It's just what you do when you have a friend that you want to bless and you want to honor. We've got friends that many of us have never met. They live on the other side of the world in India, who we've funded and are helping rescue girls who've been kidnapped and sold into slavery and sex slavery and are now being rehabilitated and are being refreshed and being renewed under the auspices or the guidance of people we're helping to fund aftercare. And we're going to have one of our friends come up in a moment who's going to share some of the role that friendship plays in rehabilitation. Her name is Smita Singh. But before we hear from her, we're going to look at one story of love, one story of sacrifice of people who have been going after and rescuing. And you'll see some blurring faces because we want to protect the identity of girls who have been rescued, and also the identity of rescuers who need to not be noticed so they can continue to rescue. Let's check this out.
You see, like tens of thousands of girls in India, I was sold into a brothel. I was treated like some kind of thing, an object. I was only 13 years old. We were forced to do things that we never wanted to do, that we can never take back, never forget. I used to wish that someone would come and take me out of that dark place.
And on that day, our investigator showed up looking for the victim girls in need of rescue. So they were 13, 14, and 15 years old. And so they were rescued, brought into aftercare. And for Suhana, what was interesting is that she began to really respond well, and she began to grow.
I was spending a lot of time with her. So our bonding kind of started off from at that point, because I would talk to her, share with her, be with her. And that continued for the next year and a half. You know, she was like my little kid that I was taking along.
Well, in aftercare, she developed a couple of relationships, and they turned out not to be good relationships. One was with a young boy who pretended to love her, tell her things like he wanted to marry her. And eventually, these relationships convinced her to run away, thinking that she would have a better life, but it ended up causing her to be re-trafficked.
She didn't come back, so they have lodged a police complaint.
So at that point, we began to question everybody we could about what happened, who she had relationships with, what the girls in the aftercare home knew about it, and we put together who this boy was and who the girl was that she met. So we began to search for this boy. We only had an area of town where he was, and we had his first name. And we spent the next several weeks looking for this young boy, and eventually we found him. He told them they had put her on a train, they had traveled together to Mumbai, where they met some other people. He was given some money and told to go back to Kolkata, and that's the last he saw of Suhana. When we heard that that's all he knew, our hearts sank because we didn't want to give up on Suhana. But Mumbai is a city of 18 million people with red light areas that have 10,000 sex workers. And so the challenge that lay before us was huge. And it was at that point that this police investigator told me personally, Suhana is gone forever. He said, you will never find her. It's impossible. You should give up. We were doing surveillance in the field, waiting for her and this female trafficker to get into an auto rickshaw. We were going to surround the auto rickshaw and re-rescue her. But she came out about 20 minutes before the police got there. She began to leave. Again, we were worried because they called the police and they said, well, we're 20 minutes away. And I said, well, she's leaving and traffic is heavy and we're going to lose her. And if we lose her, we might never find her again. And so then my investigator and myself literally forced the auto rickshaw to the side of the road and we surrounded it. I was just thinking to myself at this time that I'm not letting anybody get between me and her. And I'm not letting anyone approach. I was not going to let her get out of our hands again. The thing that I remember the most to this day is when Smita showed up. Because when Smita Singh showed up and sat down next to her, Suhana melted and she began to cry. She began to talk to Smita about how she had given up and thinking no one was going to come for her again.
After that, Smita from IJM came. And then I started crying.
And then she realized that we love her and that's why we've come to find her again. And that was just amazing for me to be able to hold her and make sure that she just stays safe.
This time I know this. I don't need to run anymore. This time, the people who did this to me aren't going to win. Love is. And because of that, I know I will make it.
Please welcome Smita Singh.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Smita, it is great to have you here. Smita and I got to know each other a couple years ago when Lib and I went over to India, got to interact with you, and you are still as short as ever. Yes, you are right here. Your foot can't even reach the thing there. That's good. I'll keep a little footstool here. There you go. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Smita, what's it like for a girl that has had these kind of atrocious things happen to her? Is it possible for them to form intimate bonds and be friends with people? What does that look like?
It is very hard for them to form bonds because they've been betrayed and hurt so many times, sometimes even by own family members. So a very important part of the rehabilitation process is creating bonds and helping them to learn to trust people again and, you know, start believing that people can love them for who they are and that they have every right to have good friendships and that they have people in their lives who will support them and just build them up no matter what. So it's very important.
Is there anything that you do to help them to bond with each other when they're in aftercare? Because a lot of us have a hard time bonding with people as well. Is there anything that we might be able to learn from them?
Two things that I've seen, two different kinds of friendships.
And by the way, that's the first time I've asked you that question, so you're thinking well on your feet. Keep going.
All right. I've seen two different kinds of friendships evolve. One is when the girls are in the brothel, they're in the midst of all the abuse, and they develop this bond because they need to keep sane, they have to keep their sanity going. And when we rescue a lot of girls out of there, many a time, somebody may have got left behind. And these girls are willing to go back into the place of their abuse to bring that friend out because they just feel that they will risk re-traumatization to get the friend out because they want her out. And on the second hand, I see that when they are out and in the process of rehabilitation and the friendships that they build up there with the staff, with the other girls in the home, that is something that again becomes so strong that it helps them to cope with all the other things, crazy things that happened in their life, and they're able to put it behind them and move forward. So I think that's really the role that friendship plays in their rehabilitation.
How about for you? Because your job, I can only imagine how difficult and draining it is. I mean, it's a job that has meaning, but being around that kind of heartache has got to wear you, at least it would me, it would wear you down. How do you keep yourself fresh?
Well, I think just being grounded in my faith, that is one very important part of my taking care of myself and my team, my friends that I work with in my work. They have been like pillars. We support each other, we are there for each other, and if it's a late night and long hours, I know my friends will prefer that I have rest while they will take on a little more stress just to make sure that I'm taking care of
them.
Absolutely. They will sacrifice their own sleep, they will sacrifice hours and time just to make sure that I'm there, and I would probably do that for them, but it doesn't ever feel like a sacrifice. It just feels that that's something you do for your friend.
Anything that, last question, anything that you feel like we all need to know or you'd like to say, your chance.
All right. Yes. I just want you all to know that I have transitioned out of IJM, and I have been fortunate enough to be in an organization that you have supported that allowed me to set up the first two Christian aftercare homes in Calcutta. So Calcutta now has Christian aftercare, which we did not have for 6 years, and we have about 28 girls there who are being cared for you, your girls. And they have a chance to hear about Jesus. They have a chance to learn, transform their lives and have hope and move ahead in their life. And all because you, 8,000 miles away, have cared enough for that. So I just want to just thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I so appreciate what you do. Thank you so much.
And we want to thank you for modeling for us what love looks like, modeling for us laying your life down and sacrificing. You sacrificed all weekend, not just coming 8,000 miles here, but you sacrificed all weekend to build into us here at Crossroads, and we are honored to have you in our midst and be in partnership with you. Let's thank Smita
for being here.
Amazing. Something powerful about laying down your life. And it doesn't have to be big, crazy stuff like the stuff in India. It's stuff like just honoring, loving, and laying your life down for your friend. It's what we see with Jonathan and David over and over and over again. In 1 Samuel 19, verse 1-3, Jonathan tells David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning, stay in a secret place and hide yourself, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you, and if I learn anything, I will tell you." Jonathan says, "My dad's coming after you, he's going to get you, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to make sure that you have warning. I am going to tell you the truth of where he is and how he's trying to scheme against you." This is another way of friends sacrifice. Friends tell the truth. Friends give truth. It's a difficult thing to give truth. because you're not sure how it's going to be received. It's not sure if you're going to be viewed as a strange person by giving it. But John said, I'm going to give you the truth about who you are and about how David or how my dad is trying to take you out. In the book of Proverbs, chapter 27, it says this about one form of truth that friends give. It says, better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Associates or enemies or people you're around will oftentimes blow wind up your various orifices and say, oh, you're so good. Good job. But a friend will take the risky thing and say, hey, I just have to tell you that I just saw something that concerns me. It's called a rebuke. Now, I kind of regret that I chose this verse to use for the speaking the truth piece, because so oftentimes we correlate speaking the truth with the negative stuff. Hey, man, I'm just giving you the truth. That's all I'm saying. I'm just giving you the truth. In other words, I'm a jerk and I'm just telling you right now. Or whenever I hear this one, hey, I just want to give the truth in love, I'm going, I don't know about that love part. I mean, it seems like you love giving the hard information, but the love part, and I myself just cringe up because I've heard enough people say they were giving the truth in love where I didn't feel a whole heck of a lot of love. But nonetheless, this is a thing where friends take a risk and they give difficult information because they want to sacrifice the possibility that you might not like me for saying this, but I like you so much I want to help you. But those times are very, very rare, probably at least 9 to 1. What friends do is they tell the truth about what is good about you, about how good you do certain things. The Bible says we should mourn with those who mourn and rejoice with those who rejoice. And it seems like a lot of people are okay with mourning with people who are down, but we're not good with rejoicing with people who are above us. Hey, man, you just got a good car. It's better than mine. Awesome. Great. Rejoice with you. Hey, man, you're just dating somebody who's healthier than my boyfriend. Wonderful. I'm excited for you. Great. Hey, you just got a great job. Good for you. Getting a promotion. I'm excited for you. Too often we're going, shoot. Because we live in this competitive country where we all want to be on the same field. And it's one of the reasons why we don't encourage people, because we feel in some sick way we might not have ever thought this out, but this I think is how it operates. We don't even want to encourage somebody and lift them up, because what happens? Where are we? Lower now. We're down here. We want everyone to be the same, and so we don't want to bump somebody up. Friends don't think that way. Friends, they want to give you the truth by taking you to new places. Got a guy I used to play basketball with, and he put himself through college in part by working at a slaughterhouse in the summers. And the guys who, the old salty guys who worked there, never been to college, never would go to college, they referred to him as, his nickname was College. And he said his first summer at this place, there was a big tractor trailer truck full of pigs that came in, and there was a bustle in the back of it because one of the pigs had snapped off the tail of the other pig. And his buddy said to him, said, hey, College, watch this. And sure enough, starting at the back of the trailer, it started to rumble. They all started jostling around, and it was a rumble and like an earthquake that moved to the very center, the front of the tractor trailer, and all of a sudden, everything just went calm. And what happened was, it happens all the time, once one of them gets their tail bitten off, they turn around to bite somebody else's tail off, and the circle goes, and as soon as everybody's tail is broken, now we're all happy now. Everybody's on the same level. We laugh, but we're pigs. We are. We almost like it when somebody has the same hardship that I have. No, friends don't think that way. I want to tell you how good you are, how thankful I am. I'm telling you the truth. Friends have made me who I am in large part because my friends will tell me the truth that other people won't. One friend that was very significant for me is, his name is Tom Dammer, he's back in Pittsburgh. And Tom took me out to the Olive Garden for lunch one day. And at that point, I was on staff at this church for 8 years. I had been born and bred in Pittsburgh. All my lifelong family, lifelong friends were there. And Tom took me down to lunch. He said, hey, I got to tell you, why are you still here? And I go, what are you talking about? He said, you have gifts and abilities that are not being used and are not being grown. It's time for you to go. It's time for you to get out and stretch yourself and have God use you in different ways. I never thought of that. I wasn't thinking that was the truth. I wasn't thinking that. I didn't want to leave all the beautiful things of Pittsburgh, the things like, you know, a football team where there's an owner who likes the city and knows leadership. I didn't want to leave those things behind. And nonetheless, I walked out of the Olive Garden I walked out of the Olive Garden and I realized, oh no, things are about to change. And it was because of that that I answered an ad in the back of a magazine with 11 people who lived in Hyde Park and Mount Lookout, who said, we want to start a church to reach our friends who've given up on church but haven't necessarily given up on God. And it's because of Tom Dammer's truth-telling conversation with me why I looked and why I ever came to Cincinnati. Had it not been for a friend who spoke the truth to me, I would not want to think about the trajectory of where my life would be. That's what friends do. They prop us up. They dust us off. They tell us things no one else is telling us. Remember in a group that I was in a few years ago, one of the journeys that we were in, I was talking in this one group meeting about some pain that had been done to me by some people, and I thought, yeah, I think I'm doing okay. I think I'm getting over it. I think I'm pretty good. And a friend of mine, Bob Schmidt, he put his hand up to his forehead, made it like a playing card, and he said, I call bullshit. I said, what are you talking about? I said, You say that, but I don't think that you are. I think that you're still harboring resentment. I don't think you are. And I was like, Why would he say that? It's because the third way the friends sacrifice, they own our problems. Friends own our problems. Bob wasn't just able to see what had happened to me. He was able to empathize, to feel it, to say that problem you're having is the problem that I feel, and therefore I have the ability to say certain things. Friends don't just notice we have problems. Friends own those problems as our problem too. This is what Jonathan does. Here's what Jonathan and David, how they interact on this point. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. Once he notices Jonathan is for David instead of for his own throne, instead of for his own succession of being the future king, Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. This is the Bible's way of saying you S-O-B. It's actually you S-O-P-R-W. You S-O-P-R-W. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame? You're going to go down, your own shame. You're going to go down by lifting him up to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send him, bring him to me, for he shall surely die. I will knock him off. Bring him here. Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. He doesn't say, man, my buddy, he's got a problem. I'll have to let him know that. No, he owns the problem. He can't eat. Can't eat. He's pledged his allegiance to his friend. Friends own problems. Maybe this is part of the reason why the Bible says, count it all joy when you undergo hardships. How do you count it joy when you're suffering, undergoing hardships? Maybe one of the reasons is when we are suffering or we are in a hardship, we not only get to identify with Jesus who suffered and was in hardship, but we get to lean into friends in a way that we can't or don't have to lean into friends when everything is perfect. Suffering and hardship causes friendships to grow. It's a little incubator for intense growth. I actually believe this is one of the reasons why America, we may be the most starved country for friendships in the world right now. I actually believe that the more money your country has or the more money you have, the less of an incentive it is to have friends. Because money can so often do for us what only a friend can do in a culture or in a life that doesn't have resources. Some of us go to counseling because we don't have friends. We have to pay somebody to be our friend. And I'm pro-counseling. I've been to counseling before. I'll go to counseling again. And I think there are times when we need a specialty of somebody who's been through something, has seen something in hundreds of different situations that can bring the right counsel to us. I'm all for that. But I also know there's a lot of people who have no ability to share their life with other people. There's people who have not fostered trust. People don't know who they are, and so they have to pay for that service. I know for me, there's things that I would always have to have friends do, but now I can kind of do it on my own. You know, when I was younger and I'm going to another city in America, I say, man, do I know any friends there? I got to stay there because I didn't have money for a hotel. A couple weeks ago, I was down in Austin, Texas for a conference, and a buddy of mine was there and said, hey, you want to stay with us? And I thought, well, that's weird. And I thought, that's weird that it's weird. the gift of hospitality, the idea of being hospitable is even being lost. We don't offer friends hospitality. They stay at a hotel, we go out to lunch, we don't cook for them, we don't clean for them. And all I'm saying is there's certain things that are a blessing about our lives and our culture that oftentimes eliminate the very need that friends have for us to step into the gap or to meet our needs, because sometimes our spending can meet our needs instead of our friends to meet our needs. Friends say, hey, your problems are my problems. Su problema is mi problema. It is. I you ever mi casa, su casa? It was kind of my twist on it. It didn't work. Whatever. All right. No pithy closing for today. Other than this week, be a friend. Be a friend. Waive your rights on something you could keep and release it. Say something to a friend that's truthful. Maybe some of us, there's a friend that has obvious destructive patterns in their life and no one loves them enough to say it. Maybe that's you who are going to be the first person that gently says it. But in all likelihood, it's going to be that you're going to have a conversation with a friend that's a truthful, encouraging, true word about them that needs to be called out. You need just to affirm them and call that out. Another application for this week is in 2 weeks, Strong Challenge starts. And man, I'm telling you, it's critical to be in a friendship kind of environment, the home teams for this. It's utterly critical. And I'm just doing everything I can to get some of us off the fence and actually engaging this journey for your benefit. IR Crush doesn't gain anything by everybody being in home teams. Actually, it would cost us less money. We'd have less materials to print. It's for you and your benefit. And let me just say this as another way to kind of push. If you've been around for a year or so, and maybe you're developing the ability to think that you're immune to things that are said here on stage. Maybe you sat out the Game Change campaign several months ago. Maybe we talked about volunteers several weeks ago. You said, I'm not doing it. Maybe we were talking about Strong Challenge home team. You're going, nah, I'm just going to show up for this. Maybe you're developing a habit to just kind of sit in a dark room and think you're growing. I'm telling you, you're not. Maybe you are to a point, but you're not. In fact, if we're not able to propel you to growth in different environments, we're just not the place for you. We're not doing a good job. We're really not. Maybe there's another environment that would help stimulate, because we're not, honestly. If repeatedly you're not willing to move or try new things, we're just not working for you. Glad you're here. It feels good when there's a big room, but we're not helping you. So I'm telling you, you need to get engaged. If you don't get engaged, you probably have some bigger issues to figure out just about your involvement at Crossroads. Probably not the place for you. I want you here, want you to be growing, and I want you to experience all that is here, including when we do this journey. So, hey, get on that. You will be very, very thankful that you did. God, I'm thankful for the friends that I have in this church, many who know me intimately, many who only know me from what I say on stage, yet nonetheless, I thank you for the sacrificial love that is here with so many people. I thank you that you are calling us to do new things, and you're calling us as individuals to encounter new friendships. I pray that the friendships that we have will be blessed this week because of what we do this week. Or perhaps the friendships we don't have will be kindled this week because of something that we do. Thank you for setting us a great model. You as a great leader, you never ask us to do anything that you haven't already done. We recognize you as a great sacrificer. Thank you. Amen. Well, part of my homework, Robbie Ryder. Every time I say that, I wish I had your name. That's like the coolest name. Rob Ryder. Like Tome. Ryder. Rob Roy Ryder. I just love that. It's wonderful. Tell you one of the things I love about you. I love about you that I've seen you regularly change. Very few people change, especially the older we get. I've seen you regularly change. I've seen you change when you came into the Crossroads environment from a different kind of church environment. You've kind of adjusted to who God wanted you to be here. I've seen me give you feedback about things that we could do better on stage, or I think we could do better, and I never see you get defensive. Even if you disagree, you never get defensive. And more often than not, you actually apply it. And even if someone doesn't give it to you, I've seen you notice people do things, and you said, man, I need to do that. I need to do it. You receive feedback and are a learner as well as anybody I know, and that's great about you. I want to be more like you in that area.
Thank you. I'll take that. Yeah, thank you. It's a little awkward.